Chapter 14. Appetite. Boiling special veal following soup, I read from the menu at the Tip of Ong Sai restaurant at Lak Sao. What could it be? Gary and I were often mystified by the English translations of menus in Southeast Asia. It seemed anything might show up on your plate or in your bowl. Finding an insect in your food, you couldn't be sure if it was supposed to be in there or not. Grasshoppers, certain grubs, even predaceous diving beetles are all relished. In Bangkok, Ian Glover, a specialist in Southeast Asian archaeology, had told me restaurant patrons sometimes dispense with the menu entirely. In Vietnam, he'd seen diners at one restaurant pointing to animals pictured on IUCN endangered species posters and telling the waiter, "I'll have one of those and that and one of these." Soups proved particularly treacherous. In Cambodia, one night when Sun Hien was not with us, I had ordered what I'd assumed to be a safe vegetarian item, fragrant flower soup. But instead of blossoms, the entree that ensued featured a thin bouillon in which floated at least 5 different digestive and excretory organs. Gary, ever the biologist, had helpfully fished each one out onto a plate for better viewing, cross-sectioning some with his knife to confirm the identification. The soup offerings at the outdoor restaurant where we found ourselves our first morning in the Annamites seemed equally mysterious. Taxonomically speaking, boiling special veal following soup appeared to be a subspecies of boiling soups, to which also belonged sour boiling eel soup and the enigmatic tasteless boiling soup. I was almost afraid to ask, for fear it might, shuddering horror, result in ordering the item, but finally I could not resist. "Bun," I asked our translator, pointing to the menu, "what is in this boiling special veal following soup?" Bun, 58, paused for a moment in his ceaseless, elegant smoking to find the right words in the right language. He spoke at least 4, Lao, Bru, French, and English, of which the latter was, unfortunately, not his forte. "It is something coming after Le Veau, you know," he answered. Jim had mentioned we might have some trouble communicating. "Bun is really good," he told us, but he cautioned, "his English is okay. His French is better than his English. He'll understand most of what you're saying." Gary and I had hoped to persuade Jim to come with us. Though he said he would have loved to, upon returning to Vientiane, Jim found an important contract had come through that he had to see to immediately. But he had arranged for us the next best option. Bun had been one of Jim's translators in the Annamites. Not only did he know the languages, he knew the people, too, as well as our own objectives. Bun and Jim had worked together for 3 decades. The two of them had set up an arm of Laotian National Studies, the Division of Minority and Ethnic Research, funded by the Asia Foundation in 1973. 2 years later, though, the Communist Revolution put an end to it. Bun then worked for the resettlement program, counting himself lucky, he told us, not to have been sent to a re-education camp. When we had met him the day before at our hotel in Vientiane, we saw immediately that Bun was a man of great learning and refinement. We could see this even in the way he held his cigarette, pinky slightly crimped and held aloft. It was a gesture I imagined he'd acquired in France, where he'd earned his baccalaureate in its language in 1965. Besides his general elegance, we noticed 2 other things about him. One was that he was a sharp dresser. When we met, he was wearing a denim vest that said Kansas on the back, a short-sleeved shirt, new shoes, and 2 rings. One ring held 4 diamonds, 1 for each of his children, 3 of whom were in college in Australia, studying electrical engineering and computers, he noted proudly. The other thing we noticed about Bun was that he had a terrible cold. This did not help our decoding of his accent, or his hearing of our numerous questions and requests. "Le Veau, you know," Bun continued congestedly, "the baby is coming. And what is following the baby that is in the soup?" I thought for a moment, and then understood. The soup's main ingredient was, as advertised, what follows the veal out of the birth canal, bovine afterbirth. Bun asked solicitously, "You would like to try it?" "No, thank you," I said with all the grace I could muster. Instead of this item issued from a cow's vagina, I ordered instead for breakfast what had recently exited a chicken's cloaca. I'll have eggs. The previous day, we'd had ample opportunity to witness the eclectic Southeast Asian appetite when we'd strolled through the Lakzow market in the golden afternoon light. Upon our arrival in the dusty timber boom town, we had first tried to visit General Cheng's menagerie, but were told that the animals there had been moved to another facility, which was closed until morning. The Lakzow market, too, was winding down for the day, but there were still plenty of women beneath umbrellas in the dust, squatting before their dwindling stock. A handful of red chilies, a bowl of giant water bugs, a pile of snails, a small pyramid of tree fungus. A middle-aged woman in a conical hat was negotiating a sale with a much younger woman. She was selling roasted rats. The shopper, wearing a neat black and white sin, the traditional slim skirt common to Thailand and Laos, carefully inspected each of the carcasses, squeezing and probing them as if they were melons, to be sure to select the finest, the fattest, and the tenderest of the 5 rats on display to cook and feed to her family. Another vendor, a woman in a green shirt, was selling smoked bats. They probably had lived in caves in the limestone karst whose jagged limestone cliffs we'd passed earlier on our drive. Cave dwelling makes bats extremely vulnerable to over-harvesting, because so many can be taken in a single evening as they emerge en masse to feed. Along with the bats, a smoked civet was for sale, its graceful, fluffy tail singed naked. Alive, civets are among the most appealing animals imaginable. Lithe climbers with soft fur adorned with bands or spots. They race up and down trees at night, their huge light-gathering eyes set in inquisitive cat-like faces. This was probably a palm civet, among the commonest of the fewer than 12 civet species in Southeast Asia, an animal the Chinese had called wind raccoon dog, because they move with such grace it was thought they waited for the wind to blow them to the next tree. We also saw tortoises for sale, and snakes, and other mammals whose bodies had been so hacked and charred that not even Gary could identify them. There seemed to be few, if any, taxa of wild vertebrates not used by some, and in many cases many, ethnic groups, be it for food, medicine, or in trade, the IUCN Wildlife Status Report had told us. In fact, throughout Laos, most animal protein consumed, according to one survey, some 82%, comes from captured wildlife. The killing of wildlife in Laos was unlike anything I had seen elsewhere, reported Alan Rabinowitz, the biologist who'd led the WCS team on the first wildlife survey of the Annamites in 1993. The skies were virtually empty of birds, and many of the rivers seemed to harbor only the smallest of fish. Hunters use every method imaginable. Snare lines, nets, and traps, dogs, catapults, and crossbows, homemade black powder muskets and automatic and semi-automatic weapons, poisons and explosives hidden in baits. Children shoot squirrels out of trees with slingshots, and professionals hunt around the clock, exposing nocturnal species with powerful spotlights. Trees are felled to remove pangolins, lorises, monitor lizards. Trees with promising crevices are even felled speculatively. And while the widespread hunting of animals is a very ancient practice here, never before in history has there been such financial incentive to do so. The sale of these wild animals, the report said, was the second biggest income earner for rural families after fishing. The trade grew exponentially in the late 1990s. Trade is driven by entrepreneurs in response to market forces, we read. One researcher reported that on several occasions he was told by Lao villagers that they would not hunt so much if the Vietnamese did not want to buy wildlife. As a result of both foreign and domestic hunting pressure, the report continued, visitors from other countries in the region generally comment on the scarcity of wild birds, bats, and other land vertebrates around Lao towns and villages. With neighborhood wildlife largely exhausted, the hunters turned to parks and sanctuaries for their larder. No experienced wildlife observer can fail to notice the low densities of wildlife in Lao PDR's protected areas, the management plan for Nakai pointed out. The intensity and efficacy of the hunting is quite remarkable. On this one afternoon at the Lac Sao market, we caught but a tiny glimpse of the immense trade in wildlife. Because of its proximity to Vietnam, the Lac Sao market had once been notorious for its open sale of endangered species. International pressure had brought a crackdown. Unfortunately, as a result, much activity became clandestine, our report noted. It is now much more difficult to monitor the volume and species range of trade. Knowing this tore at our hearts as we surveyed the market. We would look up from the corpses of slain animals to angelic faces. The vendors offered us beautiful, welcoming smiles, even though they surely realized there was little chance of selling us their bats or rats or smoked civets. One shopper pointed me out to her baby. I was probably one of the few Western women the mothers had ever seen. The infant stared at me wide-eyed, in that startled way all babies take in everything in this strange, hungry new world. The clouded leopard sprang as if he were flying and caught the chicken in midair. He landed upside down, clinging by his claws to the wire mesh of his ceiling, pinning the dead bird that had been tossed to him between his teeth and the wire. Soon a thick orange fluid dripped down his black lips, staining his spotted chest. The hen had an egg inside her. The leopard's name was George, the young woman who escorted us through the little zoo told us. She led us down the dirt paths that wound through jungle-like vegetation to introduce us to the inmates. Though the zoo was now open, the man who ran the place was not in that morning. We would meet him later that afternoon. Meanwhile, his assistant showed us the animals, although we were forbidden from taking pictures or plucking any hair. Next we came to a large cage of binturongs, including three young. They were so tame we could put our hands through the mesh and stroke them, and inhale their lovely fruity musk. But the rest of the animals weren't so lucky. The zoo also had four masked palm civets in a cage so filthy that their feces had grown a coat of purple mold. Cages housing three leopard cats and a golden cat were also tiny. The facility had once been supported by an American-based wildlife charity, Carnivore Preservation Trust. We had read about it in one of the reports. It said this zoo, which was supposed to be a breeding center for endangered carnivores, held 67 individuals of 19 species. Where, we wondered, had they gone? Lastly, we were led to the cages for the bears. Jim had visited 4 years ago and told us there had been quite a few bears. The cages were tiny. Two sun bears were caged together, and a third, very thin, paced psychotically in his 12-by-12-foot enclosure. "I don't have a good feeling about what happened to all those bears," Gary told me. There was only one moon bear, a medium-sized adult male who looked at us with benign interest as we approached his cage. Clearly, he wanted to come over to the side of the cage and sniff us. But in horror, we soon realized why he did not. His hindquarters were paralyzed. He had been in this condition for a month, the zoo assistant said. Nobody knew what was wrong. He had not been seen by a vet. Later, when we returned to meet with the manager, a pleasant young man named Quito, we learned that in 1998 there had been 9 bears. That year, the Carnivore Preservation Trust had withdrawn its support. "We don't have enough funds," he told us through Bun. "They ate the honey, the meal. Now we don't have enough." 5 bears had died of starvation. "At the moment," he said, "still alive are 4. Gary and I gave him our last $100 bill and asked him to buy food for the animals. Lac Sao, like many modern towns, was founded on appetite. Each side of the border hungers for the products of the other. Vietnamese want the wildlife and timber products of Laos. Laotians want the manufactured products from Vietnam. Laotians buy Con Soc, squirrel brand, batteries, and the Vietnamese buy live and dead squirrels from Laos. Lak Sao had been carved out of the hills in the 1980s by Pu Doi, the military-controlled logging company, the only one in the country exempt from a logging ban enacted in 1991 to facilitate border trade with Vietnam. Pu Doi, it was clear, owns the town. We noted immediately the Pu Doi Hotel, the Pu Doi Restaurant, Pu Doi Transportation, Pu Doi Guest House. We learned that since the Carnivore Preservation Trust left, the timber concession had also taken over the zoo, where the animals were starving. The town is full of machines. Chainsaws buzz, trucks roar, dust flies. Earth-moving equipment is everywhere, and sun-baked plastic bags spill like tumbleweeds across the treeless landscape, catching only on barbed wire fencing surrounding the pretentious cement homes. Lak Sao is an ugly place in a breathtakingly beautiful setting, a tumultuous commercial wound in a sanctuary that had served for eons as a refuge from turmoil. Once we'd left Vientiane, we'd watched the landscape float by as if in a dream. Cement houses give way to stilts and thatch and bamboo, to fields recently cleared by fire, to wallowing water buffalo, their skins luscious with mud, to ponds abloom with pink lotus. This time of year is known as the scented season, Bun told us, because so many flowers are in bloom. But gone, along with the stupefying heat, are the emerald fields of young rice of summer. It's the dry season now, and many of the tree's leaves have turned brown and fallen. When we got out of the car to stretch, the leaves crunched like potato chips beneath our feet. At the wheel of our immaculate Toyota Prada was Bunjan. Like Bun, he's originally from Languedoc. He's a much younger man, strong and burly, whose sparse hair stands out on the sides of his head like spines on a hedgehog or on a durian. He speaks no English, and we know Lao, so we simply smiled and nodded at one another, hoping he would know how grateful we were for his skills. On he drove along the winding roads, past startling jagged limestone cliffs like those on Chinese scroll paintings. Below us coursed the brown Nam Thun River, peppered with dugout canoes. Around us loomed a forest dark and deep, huge trees roped with lianas, bamboos their stems and leaves in sprays as wide as fireworks, and the fluffy white seed heads of the grass the Lao used to stuff their mattresses. Along one hairpin curve, Boone swerved to avoid a giant truck that had jackknifed and spilled its cargo, a yellow bulldozer, onto the side of the mountain below. Two men squatted in the shade of the fallen monster, playing cards. "This is the kind of country that Cheminode claims the dog bear lives in," said Gary. The scientist had painstakingly translated much of the French overseer's 239-page memoir, Mes Chasses au Lao, from the French. "This active, elongate, supple bear lives on the high plateaus of the Annamites, getting rarer to the south until it vanishes," the hunter wrote. "In the north, these bears can be hunted when they descend to the bases of plateaus during the dry and cold season between November and March. They are usually seen in pairs, less often in small groups. Standing on two legs, this species is about the height of a small man. Its postures can resemble those of a dog. The thick black fur gleams." Unlike the sun bear, the dog bear boasted large upright ears and a narrow face. In fact, Cheminode said he had examined similar stuffed specimens in an Uzbekistan museum, which had been labeled as moon bears, Ursus tibetanus. But the dog bear, he claimed, had shorter hair and was also much smaller, scarcely attaining half the 140 kilos listed at the museum, with a mean length of a meter without the tail and a height of about 0.40 meters. "Is this the same dog bear the Hmong described to us? Is it a new species of bear? If so, why has it still remained undiscovered by science?" "Maybe," ventured Gary, "a few hundred thousand years ago, a third species of bear went extinct in the climatic fluctuations of the Pleistocene, everywhere but here." "Most people think of the Pleistocene as the Ice Age," he explained, "but really it was a time of great climatic change, not just cold. In Europe, true, the Pleistocene included periods so cold that great sheets of ice spread over much of the continent. But these glacial periods were interspersed with warm, wet times called interglacials, during which tropical forests grew and spread for millennia, and along with them, animals we think of as tropical too. During one recent interglacial, a period known as the Eemian, 100,000 years ago, the world so warmed that hippos lounged in the Danube and Thames. Gigantic straight-tusked elephants standing 15 feet high at the withers overran northern Europe. Enormous cave lions spread from Africa into northern Asia, North America, and South America, as far south as Peru. The moon bear then thrived as far into Europe as Germany, along with grizzlies and cave bears, and the beetle-brown Neanderthals may have hunted them with their fire-hardened yew spears. But soon another glaciation followed. Much of the world's water was locked up in ice. The temperature change altered worldwide rainfall patterns. In Asia, the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas, which began to rise when the Indian subcontinent hit Eurasia in the Miocene and are still rising today, created the updrafts that sculpt the monsoons. But during glaciations, these forces were disrupted, and the life-giving southern monsoons failed. Cold, dry winds whipped up black blizzards across China. The Danube dried to a trickle. The hippos retreated. The cave lions vanished. In the tropics, thorn scrub grew where rainforests once flourished. In the past million years, the world has undergone such sweeping turmoil some dozen times. The huge temperature changes were, in a way, the least disruptive of these transformations. Anything that survived the temperature and habitat changes also had to deal with the resultant disappearance of important food and prey items and the invasion of new predators and competitors. It was not heat or cold that vanquished Neanderthal man during the minor glacial retreat between 40,000 and 30,000 years ago, but the arrival of Cro-Magnon man, the first Homo sapiens. With their invention of the atlatl, or spear thrower, these invaders from the south outcompeted their predecessors. Homo sapiens alone, among the species of humans, survived through the next cold glaciation in Europe, the heyday of the European mammoths and reindeer. Only a very resilient, adaptable fauna could survive such tremendous flux, unless it could find a refuge to which to retreat and wait out the centuries-long storm. Such a refuge, Asian wildlife experts believe, was the Annamite Mountains. This part of the world has persisted longer than most of the Amazon, Gary told me. During much of the Pleistocene, much of the Amazon's present rainforest was grassland. But in the Annamites, the montane forests would have been large and resilient, and the bears would have found habitat. Perhaps a new species of bear had arisen during one of the early glacial periods, when Southeast Asia's rainforests were fewer and farther apart, separated by vast oceans of scrub and grassland. Barriers between the different populations, setting them apart, is what creates more speciation, Gary explained. A little bit of climate change can promote diversity. Too much, of course, and you lose what you have. So the third kind of bear might have disappeared through most of its former range during one of the climatic upheavals, but it could have persisted here. Such is the theory explaining why the sow la, the Vietnamese warty hog, the two new muntjacs, and the zebra-striped rabbit persisted here and only here. On the other hand, and Gary always considered each new theory along with its opposite, perhaps the moon bears didn't make it to Southeast Asia until quite recently. Perhaps they had come in separate groups from different parts of Asia. After all, he pointed out, moon bears today have an enormous distribution. Unlike most other species of bear, the moon bear overlaps its range with many of its fellow ursines. Sun bears, grizzlies, even pandas. Even though those species each prefer different altitudes and habitats within the same general range, moon bears could have entered Southeast Asia from almost any direction except the south. So much of this is intuitive, he said to me. For Gary, hypotheses seem to wink on and off like fireflies. One idea would appear, and then immediately its opposite, yin and yang, darkness and light. I agree with Robert Ardrey, Gary said. A good scientist has the duty to be wrong. if you think about hypotheses, some of them are going to be wrong. If you're too scared to be wrong, you're never going to do anything important. And if you don't have hypotheses, he said, it's impossible to interpret data. Or at least, that's what Sherlock Holmes says. On the way to Lac Zao, we had stopped for lunch at the village of Ban Pakading, at a tin-roofed outdoor restaurant serving fried vegetables and meat and rice, and sat beneath a great tree where women were selling dried fish, bananas, dried buffalo meat, and coconuts. Along the dirt path leading to the restaurant's latrine, I discovered a black-and-white sow who had given birth to her three piglets so recently that one of them was still covered in afterbirth. Two older black piglets ran loose through the little dirt compound in back of the restaurant, among strutting turkeys, a stately white goose, and a curly-tailed, black-faced white dog. I raced back to interrupt Gary's lunch and show him the piglets. He watched them respectfully and with great concentration. When we got back in the car, the scientist said, "Seeing the pigs really helped." "Yes, I agreed. What could be more helpful, more jolly and uplifting than the sight of a pig? The unlikely bulk mincing along on tiptoe hooves, the fat lady in high heels, the sensuous, flexible nose disc capable of uprooting small trees with one gesture. And it's always delightful to watch a pig eat. What other event offers such a chance to see someone so thoroughly, so greedily engrossed in appetite? Pigs remind us of ourselves. Indeed, they're so like us, their bodies are used to study human physiology, and their skin and the valves of their hearts are used for human transplants. The proto-Thai speakers of the Lower Yangtze shared an appreciation of pigs. Jim's thesis mentioned a pig god, Chang Ta Ti, worshipped in A.D. 265 to 317 as the creator of wet rice agriculture. Which, Jim pointed out, the pig was. By rooting in the low-lying swamplands, pigs, in effect, plowed the land for the farmers. So for many minutes, it did not occur to me to ask Gary what specifically had improved in his life due to seeing the pigs. "Seeing that blunt snout," he told me, "now I can really see the pig analogy in sun bears." But as we were to discover the next day, after I had finished my eggs at the restaurant and George the snow leopard had finished his at the zoo, our original information about the pig bear turned out to be wrong. And learning this, our quarry transformed once again. The first village we visited was a Hmong settlement of 36 families. It was a raw-looking, dusty little village, many of the stilt houses new. The people had moved here only 11 years ago. "Always they move because of the paddy field," explained Bun. "Maybe next step they move over here, or over here," he said, pointing to the forested hills where perhaps the last of the mystery bears still survived. Gary and I shuddered at the thought. Jim had told us that the Hmong, while excellent hunters, were not great taxonomists. "The Hmong are newcomers," he reminded us. "They are very nice people, they are good hunters, but they're completely out of place here. I would view anything that they tell you taxonomically as suspect. They hunt first and name later." But still, we wanted to confirm what we had heard in Skokie and in northern Thailand. Unlike the Lahu, the five young men who greeted us when we came to their village immediately recognized the pictures of the sun bear. But they called it Dai Day, dog bear. Immediately, too, they knew our picture of the moon bear. And they called this Dai Mua, pig bear. It was exactly the opposite of what we thought Xu Tong Vong had said. If what they told us were true, the new species of bear was not the dog bear at all. They hunted both kinds of bear, the men in short black pants told us. "Very good eating," Bun translated. Everything, in fact, was good eating. Everything except snakes, which they killed but did not eat, and baby mice. The most terrible of evil spirits, they believe, live underground and not infrequently assume the form of helpless baby mice if you happen to surprise them by turning up the stone underneath which they live. These are never killed, for if you do so, someone in your family will surely die. Our informants did not know of golden bears, and they had never seen anything like the golden bears in our pictures. But they knew of another kind of bear, they said, though no one among them had ever seen it. They called it Dai Neng, the horse bear, for it was a giant. It lived further north in Xiangkhouang province. To thank them for their time, we gave the men each a pack of Camel cigarettes. They examined the drawing on the pack carefully and with much interest. "What sort of creature is this?" asked a balding man with gold teeth. "Where do you hunt it?" I pictured them setting snares in the jungle for Joe Camel. "Giant bears," Gary said aloud to the empty room as I came to retrieve him for dinner. Most of the time, when he's thinking like this, Gary is utterly silent. Once I had found him staring out the window of a hotel room. The window was curtained closed. Now, once again, I had come upon the professor lost in thought. What was he thinking? "For months I've been thinking about pygmy bears," he told me. "Now it looks like the third species, if there is one, is a giant." During our first days in Bulikamsai province, two Hmong villages, plus a Hmong we met along the roadside, had provided the same information. There were three kinds of bears. One was clearly the sun bear. Another was clearly our moon bear. And there was a third, much larger, as long as a horse, and so heavy it took 6 to 8 strong hunters to carry the corpse away. "Is it a new species? Or just a larger montane form of the moon bear? Or perhaps just big old males?" "This we don't know. The Hmong do not keep skins or skulls. It is possible that we already have the specimen we need. 4 samples taken from the moon bears originally from Bulikamsai province are now at Lizette's lab, awaiting analysis, which might prove so different from the others as to constitute a third species, or a subspecies." "Even the giant bear's meat is different," we were told by one informant, Yanu, 39, from the village of Bon Pon Sat, whose father had killed one some years ago. "The gall is superior, too," he told us. "Not only does it supply enough bile to fill a beer can, but it's more curative," he insisted, "than the gall from the sun or moon bear. It lived on Pu Viang Mountain. There was once a road there, but it washed out." Jim Chamberlain later told us this might be a mountain about a day's walk from the Hmong and Liha villages we had visited the day before. "Does this bear still exist there today?" "Oh, yes," our informant assured us. "Just 2 years ago, when the Hmong were clearing new land for their cornfields, they found its footprints. They are unmistakably huge." He looked around for something for a size comparison. He settled on Gary's size 10 Converse All-Stars. "They are as big as that," Bun translated, as we all but Gary, marveled at the unfathomable enormity of the feet of both the giant bears and the silver-haired Western scientist. Other than the Hmong, none of the other villagers in the province knew of the giant horse bear. Interestingly, when we asked about bears, the other villagers had told us to ask the Hmong. They were the best hunters, everyone seemed to agree. But what the others had to tell us spoke eloquently and elegiacally of the fate of species known and unknown, and the fate of the people themselves. "The Pekom Koi is invisible, but you can hear him. Chop, chop, chop! Kong, kong, kong!" the creature calls in the night. Even if you've already made camp, even if your nighttime fire is already blazing, if you hear it, you should move on. "If you stay, the Pekom Koi will eat you," the young Liha warned us. And he knew the Pekom Koi was real. He had heard its eerie calls himself just this year as he had camped near its lair in a cave near water in the mountains. "You must be careful not to disturb the spirits of the forest," the men of Ban Hua Khan told us. "Besides the Pekom Koi, who's invisible, there's another greatly feared monster, the Pinya Wai. It looks rather like an ordinary gibbon, but you can be sure it's a spirit, all right. This creature cannot be killed, not even with an AK-47. And if you anger him, he will create storms and wind, rain and darkness. He lives in the mountains, and the people are careful not to invade his forest home. Even now, the men told us, if you go to that big mountain, the Pinya Wai will see you. The wind and rain comes," Bun translated, "blowing smoke like a magician, and it will be like night." To the Liha, the forest is more than one great grocery store, a source of income or a repository of resources to serve their appetites. The forest is a place of mystery and inspiration, alive with its own appetites and desires. Long ago, before the people lived in the village, the Liha had lived as hunter-gatherers, Bun explained to us. He knew because he had been to this village before. In fact, Ban Huakan had been one of the very first villages he and Jim had visited on their expedition to the Annamites 4 years earlier. Bun received a warm welcome when we alighted from our car in the neat, pretty settlement, with its stilt homes walled with woven bamboo, set among trees whose leaves can be brewed for tea, little gardens and dirt paths and peeping chicks. We took off our shoes, climbed the ladder, and were welcomed into the great room of one of the larger stilt houses, where a woven cradle hung from a rafter, corn dried above the hearth, and black iron kettles were stacked neatly by the fire. We asked what bears the people knew. They described the sun and moon bears. They liked to eat both of them, they told us, especially relishing the paws. They used the gall for medicine. We asked if they had any stories about bears to tell us, and they said no. Was there a bear spirit, I wondered? Our spirit animal is the dhole, one of our informants, Po Pei 60, told us through Bun. This Bun already knew, for it was here that he and Jim had collected the one surviving myth, possibly common to all the Vietic peoples, one that Jim determined was the key to understanding Vietic culture. The myth, as Jim tells it in his report, goes like this. Most people died, but there was one man who lived 300 years and still had not died. So they, the ones who had died, went up to the chief heavenly spirit and complained that they were always dying, whereas there was this one man who lived 300 years and was still alive. So the heavenly spirit sent 3 children down from heaven to inquire after the old man. They went and found him fishing. "Hey, old man," they asked, "have you ever seen stones floating upward?" "Oh, you youngsters," he answered, "I am more than 100 years old and still haven't seen this." "Are you the one who is 300 years old?" "Yes, that's me." "Then come with us." But first the old man had to see after his companions, a dog and a chicken. "I must take my dog and chicken home first." The heavenly children would not wait, but they asked him what they should do to look after the animals. "No one must destroy my dog and chicken," he replied. "Whoever shoots them will get impetigo. If you shoot and miss, may your flesh rot. Do not shoot them, not hit them. Let them go." The people took the old man away. He did not return home. But to this day, the dhole and the crow cannot be killed or eaten. Because the myth may be common to all the Vietic groups, Jim had told us it speaks across the ages of an ancient and sacred relationship between animals and hunter-gatherers. It is a tale that tethers the people to each other, to the animals of the forest, and to the nourishing abundance of the earth. The tale tells us of animal powers. In it, the dhole is no less than the intermediary between life and death, transforming living creatures into food for the people. The crow is his sacred emissary. To forget this, as the old man warns, is to incur grave consequences. And those consequences, we were to learn, are already upon us. For centuries, the myth has served the people, reminding them who they are. And it has helped the dholes, too. These fox-like wild dogs, with their bushy black-tipped tails and reddish coats, have been persecuted to near extinction almost throughout their enormous range, from West Asia to China, India, Indochina to Java. Most hunters consider them rivals, for they're highly efficient killers. 2 or 3 dholes can kill a 110-pound deer within 2 minutes, attacking from behind and disemboweling the prey. Dholes usually hunt in family packs, usually 5 to 12 animals, but sometimes up to 40, keeping together by communicating constantly by whines, growls, screams, shrieks, and whistles. They are excellent swimmers, who often chase their prey to water. They will take down deer, pigs, antelopes, even animals as big as buffalo-like gaur. And they will even kill tigers, leopards, and bears. In the Dolls, the Phaetic people have found creatures well worthy of emulation. They are brave and strong, honor family ties, and have learned to cooperate among themselves to survive. Gary and I would have loved the chance to spot a Dole. Could any of the villagers take us to see some? Before, there were a lot in this area, Mepe 50 told us through Bun. There were 50 of them living near some years ago, he said. Many different animals, tigers, bear, deer, used to inhabit the forest here, he said. Now, we don't know where they live. We live in a society where buffalo are killed, and Dholes would kill the buffalo, too. And so the Dholes have disappeared. Again and again, at village after village, we heard different versions of the same story. As wildlife diminished, as the forest shrank, as war nipped at their heels and the dam's apocalyptic construction approached, the people diminished too. Not that their numbers were shrinking. In fact, except for the hunter-gatherers, most of the human population of Nakai was growing, we had read in our reports. But their knowledge, their languages, their traditions, their connection to the earth, their sacred compacts with the animals, all were falling away. Increasingly, we had the feeling that we had arrived during the sunset of these cultures, and that soon the people would find themselves enveloped by the dark. At Ban Pon Sai, a Thai Mway village of 46 homes, a very old, very thin man with a crew cut and few teeth told us the people named their clans after animals. His family name was Tong Lo, after the Tong Lo bird with its crest of black and white feathers. Other families were named after the tiger or the monitor lizard, and those clans considered these animals the founders of their lineage. They would not hunt or eat their ancestors. You respect these creatures as if they're your family, he told us. But he could not remember the stories of how these animals founded the lineages. The people and the animals could once talk, he told us, but what they said to one another, he said, no one could now recall. Gary and I wondered if perhaps the people simply didn't want to tell us their stories. After all, we were strangers, and we were asking them to share with us some of the deepest aspects of their culture. Perhaps they said they did not remember only because they were too polite to tell us to buzz off. Sometimes the people were visibly nervous about talking with us. Because of our pale skins and foreign ways, they feared we might have been sent by the authorities, the people who planned to flood the villages in a few short years, the people who were ferreting out insurgents. I tell you, this district 1 week ago, they were fighting over here, the Résistance, Pon told us, in an accent that sang, Allons enfants de la patrie. This is not 100% safe. Generally, though, when they learned we only wanted to talk about animals, the people welcomed us into their stilt houses to sit beside their fires with them as they struggled to recall what was once central to their lives. But over and over again, in response to our questions, people answered like head injury victims, vaguely aware they were suffering from some terrible loss, but unable to recall what it was, or even remember how they lost it. Again and again we heard these words. We do not remember. The people of Ban Na Li belong to an ethnic group called Qian. The people of the village have distinctive and beautiful pink round faces. The girls wear long dangling gold earrings. Before, Mo Vang, 62, tells us through Bun as we sit by his fire, we don't eat the elephant, the tiger, or the bear, because it was sacred wildlife. But now the people have begun to eat everything. Bun Mi, another village elder, tells us he remembers when bears used to come to raid the corn in his village, but that was when he was a child. Now you have to go very far to see bears, to the mountain, he said. In fact, the men gathered at the fireside agreed all the wildlife is disappearing. Even the Pinya Wai and the Pekam Koi don't live here anymore. Mo Vang is one of two shamans, or Ma, in the village, and among his duties is to differentiate when a patient has an illness caused by hungry spirits or an illness that can be healed with herbs. One way to tell is by consulting a set of 29 bamboo sticks, bun called siam. Mo Vong shows us some. They are longer than Mo Vong's hands, but they remind me of his fingers. Gnarled and dark, they look so much a part of him. To heal an illness, he told us, first you get a shirt from the sick person, a candle, a mirror, and some cigarettes, some money, and flowers. You make a prayer to the spirits. Then you sort the sticks, almost like shuffling cards, as he shows us, and divide them into three groups, each held between the fingers of one hand. One group of sticks tells of the health of the heart, another of the health of the feet, another of the health of the spirit. The number of sticks that ends up between each group of fingers is guided by the spirit and tells you the answer you need. It takes many years to learn to read the siam, he tells us, and he is very old. Does he have a young apprentice, we ask? No, he tells us. So who will read them for the villagers when he is gone? This he doesn't know. The Qian have their own written language, he tells us by his fire, but there is only one book. Would we like to see it? He descends the ladder stairs to fetch it for us. When he returns, he's bearing an ordinary school child's 100 pages brand paper and cardboard notebook. In blue bold script, the last surviving words in the native language have been written in ink by his teacher, a man now long dead. This, he tells us, is the only existing copy. The book, he tells us, is sacred. His eyes loom large and bleary behind thick glasses, and he begins to read aloud. The words are difficult for him. He reads falteringly. He does not read the book often, he explains. What do the words tell us? At first, in translation, the purpose of the book is unclear. Is it a prayer? Is it a history? Actually, it is both and more. The book, we finally discern with Bun's help, is read at a funeral ceremony, after a buffalo has been killed to nourish the soul along the journey on which it's about to embark. The words in the book, though, are even more critical to the soul than the spiritual meat of the buffalo. This is the set of directions the soul must carefully follow on its long, dangerous quest after death into the afterlife. The words of the book tell the spirit how to find his way back to the ancestral homeland, Mong Kele, a place somewhere along the Vietnamese and Chinese borders. Only if the dead person can find Mong Kele can he complete his pilgrimage, retracing his ancestors' steps as they had come from here to Than Hoa in Vietnam and then to Lao. And only then can the soul ascend to Then Chau, or heaven, and from there help look after his descendants on earth. Without the book's instructions, not only the dead person, but also his descendants would suffer. Without the book, the soul would literally be lost. And this is the only copy. One tippy cup of tea, one rainstorm, one fire could obliterate the words from the pages. But the equivalent catastrophe is already underway. Mo Vong is one of only two people in the village who knows how to read the ancestral language. The other is a person nearly as aged as he. No one else wants to learn the language. Not even the four surviving children of his original nine. Everyone reads and writes in Lao now, Tao Mai, another village elder with a neat gray crew cut, explains. Literacy in Lao was one of the gifts of progress the government and foreign charities wished to bestow on the tribal people. But it is one of many such programs that has backfired miserably, Jim had told us. Education doesn't prepare you for everything, Jim said. There was one profession for which literacy seemed important in some of the remote Annamite villages, he said. The educated women from the minority ethnic groups were able to become highly successful prostitutes. These women were in school so much they lost the opportunity to learn from the village elders, he said. They were then lured into prostitution, and not unwillingly. They were learning to speak Lao so they could speak to the customers. all the girls had completed secondary school. But the government and charities insisted that people needed this sort of formal education, like they needed hospitals. But actually, these people would rather die in their village than go to a hospital, Jim had said, and we knew from the Hmong that that was true. The problem, Jim had told us, was that government and charities, however well-intentioned, did not understand the cultures they were trying to help. They did not understand that in many cases, instead of meeting existing needs, they were creating new ones. They've equated subsistence with poverty, and not without help from the World Bank and the IMF, International Monetary Fund, Jim said. But for many of the Lao and other ethnic groups, enough is sufficient. Why would you want more? Such had been the case in Cambodia, too. The author of a book published in 1970 had reported with amusement what one farmer said to a group of U.S. aid workers trying to persuade him to raise more rice per paddy with their modern methods. "I have enough for my family," the man replied. "I've seen the king, and he looks well-fed, so he must have enough, too. Why bother with more?" But to Western minds, if you live with just enough of everything, there's something wrong. Enough is not enough, says the Voice of Progress, the World Bank, the anti-poverty charities. You need more. So the World Bank comes in and says, let us help you. The villages get electricity and the people see television. They see these things on TV and now they want them, Jim had told us. And now you have poverty where there was none before. Not all the fruits of Western progress are evil, of course. Many are wondrous. Were it not for his eyeglasses, for instance, Mo Vong could not read the sacred words of his teacher. Organizations like CARE save lives by bringing vaccines, vitamins, and emergency rations during famine. Perhaps they could have saved the 5 children whose deaths Mo Vong still mourns. But even the most high-minded of charities can err dangerously. In seeking to eliminate hunger, they may instead create new appetites. Westerners see Laotians living in houses made by hand, eating food grown from seed, their children taught by village elders, and their sick doctored in their own homes by learned shamans and cured with plant medicines, and they feel sorry for them. I remembered what an aid worker stationed in Lao had told Stan Sesser, the author of an article on Lao titled Forgotten Country, which ran in the New Yorker magazine. Life is a struggle, he said. To illustrate this to a fellow Westerner whose computer-centered culture increasingly imprisons its workers in glass and steel boxes for 8, 10, or 12 hours a day, the aid worker continued the lament. For these Laotians, most of one's labor is consumed in monotonous tasks like carrying water, pounding husks off the rice, and hoeing the soil. Ironically, I would later read in the New York Times travel section that city workers are now increasingly seeking vacations on working farms, paying for the chance to help with daily chores, much like those the aid worker found so odious. And I remembered a story I had read in The Same Acts Twice, Restoration and Renewal in a Throwaway Age. It is a book about America's hunger to reclaim what our culture is losing. The grace of old houses, the solace of open spaces, the darkness of the night skies, the silences and natural sounds that are now largely obliterated by the noise of machines. It's a story taken from the Tao, the holy book of a branch of Buddhism based on the teachings of a 6th century BC Chinese philosopher. A learned master, walking in the country with his disciples, came upon a man toiling to water his garden, hauling jars of water from a well. The master told him he should use a shadoof, a wonderful new invention, a long pole weighted at one end to dip a bucket of water at the other end with great ease. With the shadoof, he could irrigate 100 gardens with less effort than he used on one. But the old gardener only laughed at the master's suggestion. He knew of the new water-moving contrivance, and he chose not to use it. He learned that such a thing would only impair his spiritual growth. He lived his life in pursuit of pure simplicity, in accordance with the teachings of the Tao. When pure simplicity is impaired, he told the master, the spirit becomes unsettled, and the unsettled spirit is not the proper residence of the Tao. The learned master was humbled into silence. Mo Vang closed the pages of the sacred book and smoothed the cardboard cover with his long, aristocratic brown fingers. I try to teach our language, Mo Vang lamented, and the young people say, why? We are a new generation, Tao Mai told us solemnly. We know nothing now.